Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening.
My next guest is Heather Lyon. Heather came to education because she wanted to write, but needed a backup plan because she knew she couldn't become a well-paid, famous author overnight. She was fortunate because her cooperating teacher was inspirational and realized she loved teaching. She also became a reading specialist after completing her master's degree in education at the University of Buffalo. And prior to that, she also got a Bachelor of Arts in English from Alfred University. Finally, she received her PhD in Education Administration from the University of Buffalo in 2010, and we'll discuss a little bit about her dissertation today. In terms of her work history, she is currently an assistant superintendent for curriculum instruction and technology for a suburban school district in Western New York State. Prior to this, she was director of elementary education in a large suburban school district. Some additional highlights of her career include her work as an English teacher, staff developer, principal, director of instruction, and is currently the assistant superintendent. In each position, she was known for her leadership among students, faculty, and staff, and her drive toward excellence for the entire school community. Welcome to the podcast, Heather.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, I've been reading your book, Engagement is Not a Unicorn, It's a Narwhal. And I want to start out with talking about what led you to write this book. Is engagement something that's kind of been one of your, just something you wanted to learn more about ever since you started teaching?
I wish that I could say, yes, engagement was something that I wanted to learn more about, but I didn't when I was a teacher, but I wasn't thinking about engagement at that point in time in the way that I think about it now. It really came about through being an administrator and being trained to go in and conduct observations of teachers. And at that point, I was, being told that I should be looking for students to be engaged. And then we would do things like go into classrooms and we would have a checklist, you know, and we would count the number of students that they were doing what they were supposed to be doing, and we would call that engaged. And something felt off about that to me, because I was also having some professional development at the same time about that engagement should be more than just looking like you're doing something, but the enjoyment of doing it, the desire to do it. So anyway, long story short, in my book, I write about how I was in a bathroom at another school. I saw a poster of Schlechte's 5 levels of engagement, and that started to feel closer to what I was feeling, but not quite right. And then, so I started to get my thinking down on paper and just to frame it. And I started talking to other people about what I was thinking. They were like, oh my gosh, that's so good. That makes so much sense. Where did you read that? And I said, no, I didn't read that. This is something that I've been thinking about. They're like, you should write a book. If you're somebody who has always wanted to write a book, but never knew what you were going to write a book on, and people are telling you, you should write a book, you start to get it down on paper more and more. And next thing you know, you have written a book.
And this came out this past December. What I like about it, I mean, it's a large book, but it's more of a workbook as well. It has the reading and short chapters, but also it has that pre-reading in each chapter with the questions going into the chapter and then the summary. And then you have some reflection questions. So it's something that would function very well in a book study, as well as just individual reading and reflecting on your own practice.
Thanks for that feedback. That's what it was designed to do. So it's nice to hear that that's how it feels. And that was feedback that I got from, you know, the reviewers who reviewed it. Because I'm up to my elbows and doing work too. And so when I read something, particularly something professional, I want to be able to not just read it and think, okay, but like use it. And so the the book is really meant for people who are doing the work and ready to use what they're reading with kids or the people that they work with.
Mm-hmm. Because once you've read it, it might go on the shelf, but then you can pull it out and you have those reflections that you've written. And you know, you can write in the margins if you run out of space, but there's plenty of space, right, for things that people want to reflect on. So I think that's great. There's not that many books for educators that you buy nowadays that have like room to just collect your thoughts, right?
Yes. So thank you for that.
So tell me about something innovative that's been going on in your district in the past year or so. I mean, everybody moved to remote learning almost a year ago now, but you've talked about you've been hybrid right now, and kind of what have educators that you've been observing and working with done that's especially kind of stood out to you?
So you're right, we're in a hybrid model, and then we have a separate remote model for those families that are not comfortable sending their kids to campus. Honestly, when I think about what is something innovative, I just think of all the innovation that has had to happen this year. I think right now what we're talking about is thinking forward to the end of the year. And how do we give students credit? Because so many kids, like there's this, yes, we have a health pandemic that we're living through, but this is creating an educational pandemic. And we have kids who, you know, really feel disconnected, disengaged, may not be doing homework, and yet they may be still knowledgeable about what the content is supposed to be. So we're having conversations right now about allowing students to have the final exam grade, if the final exam grade is passing, but the child hasn't passed the course according to the other criteria, to allow that final exam grade to be the thing that allows the kids to pass.
Okay.
And while there might be other school districts who have historically done that, this is not reinventing the wheel. It's a newer approach for us to think about it. And it's also expanding the teacher's understanding of really what is a grade. We put so much stake into averages and collecting homework, but the truth is that, you know, with athletes, we don't grade their practice.
We know
what they're capable of by the actual competition that they participate in, the event. With actors and performers, we don't grade their practice or the dress rehearsals. They're rated based on how well they do in the actual performance. And yet with schools, we grade the practice. We assess the practice in ways that are more than just feedback to kids. It's a, this is a part of your overall average, as though that overall average then represents their knowledge of the content, which it doesn't. If you're counting in the learning that they are striving to achieve by the end. Also, we grade things like a notebook check, or we give extra credit for bringing in a box of tissues. Things of that nature that have absolutely, it had nothing to do with the content that that they would be expected to know, but their behaviors towards learning. And that's behaviors, like you can be a jerk, but know the content. Or you can be a really nice and respectful kid and not know the content. But what we're communicating on the report card should be a function of the knowledge of the content. Not, we can separate the behaviors related to learning and indicate that. We tend not to do that at a secondary level, but we could. But, you know, if my kid has my daughter in her science class this year, her teacher gives extra credit for everything. So she has over 100 average, but I assure you, she does not know more content than she's supposed to in that science class. She's just getting the extra credit.
Yeah, and that takes me back to about 15 years ago where I taught students in the IB program, and you know, it was rigorous instruction. And, you know, we a lot of what we did in French 4 and 5 was prepare for the IB test and take some of those practice tests as part of the grade. But I remember there were a lot of students, you know, they might have had a C at the end of the year, but I gave them all these extra credit opportunities, right? And they were tied to the curriculum, but just, I remember kids scrambling to get, it wasn't just a Kleenex box, but I have used that as the 10 points, right? And, yes. And it's like, is that really showing though? Like if they're scrambling to get extra credit and they get 50 extra credit points at the end of the year to bring their grade up to the next letter grade, is that really showing that they know the content? I mean, but yeah. I agree with you as well in the fact that, you know, an athlete's not graded on a game, right? So why should we grade a kid along the way for that practice up to that summative assessment? I worked in a school once where we did, we graded the summative 80% and the formative 20%. And, you know, there are a lot of different variances of how schools grade and standards-based grading versus not. But, mm-hmm. you know, I really like how you're pointing out that fact that, you know, the student could be compliant, like you're talking about a lot in the book, a lot of that compliance piece behaviorally, they are paying attention, right? They're looking like they're engaged, yes. but it's just compliance as right. opposed to actually knowing the material and being directly engaged. And that's where you're getting that on the summative assessment, you're knowing, do they know the material or not?
Right. So that whole compliance piece, it breaks my heart because in schools, most of the time, as long as you are compliant with the behavioral expectations, mm-hmm. you can be non-compliant with the learning yeah. because adults leave kids alone who leave other kids alone. Mm-hmm. And so we're just killing them softly because mm-hmm. we're not really expecting them to do the learning. We will allow kids to opt out as long as they don't disrupt learning mm-hmm. for others.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking.
Yep. And that's true. Like sometimes we've just made it easier on ourselves, right?
Yes.
Because we want to quote unquote cover the curriculum or get to this point, right? Or you might make it easier on everybody.
Yes. And the easiest thing, I'm sorry, just one more thing. I just want to say that the mm-hmm. easiest thing that we can do to intervene with that behavior is to tell kids, I don't call on kids who raise hands. Don't raise your hand in this class. Mm-hmm. I am going to ask the question and then I'm going to randomly pick somebody to answer. So mm-hmm. using something like equity sticks or, you know, all the kids have a number and you use a random number generator, mm-hmm. whatever the case may be. But if teachers call primarily on kids who raise their hands mm-hmm. and they leave kids alone who don't raise their hand, and I'm a quiet kid who doesn't raise my hand, I may be paying attention, but how do you know? How do you know that my mind is on the learning?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you know, if you're using that method, you always have the same kids raising their hands.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, you have the kids know that I'll answer this question because I know it. Mm-hmm. And I won't put my hand up if I don't know it, but I'm also off the hook if I don't know it. And classrooms are not generally safe places to fail. Mm-hmm. There's this weird culture that we create in classrooms as though you must get it right the first time. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get it right, first of all, we'll grade you on your first attempt anyway. Mm-hmm. And then we don't give makeup opportunities or, you know, things like that. But like human beings are wired to be resilient. That's how we all learn to walk and talk. Mm-hmm. And so imagine if, We showed a child, here's how you walk. Here's how you walk. You get your one chance. Then if you don't do it for now, you failed. I'm going to give you a failing grade. Mm-hmm. Eventually, mm-hmm. you'll probably learn to walk, but I got to put this in as the average mm-hmm. of what it is you're capable of doing. And so by the time they get to walk, they might be failing, you know, because they haven't done it yet before. So they get a failing average, but they've achieved the learning that's necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And everybody learns at a different rate. Right. And that's kind of where those, when I taught with standards comes in, because I worked at a school where you could hit those learning targets at any time during the semester. And it was a frustration for the teachers, because you did have kids, needing several retakes, but it also gave students the opportunity, if they needed extra time to learn something, they would then be able to take a test at a certain date within that grading period. So,
yeah.
Wanted to talk with you about your hopes for the upcoming school year in your job as an assistant superintendent of curriculum instruction and tech. So tell me a little bit about your school district and maybe some of your thoughts in terms of budget innovation and lessons learned in the past year that you'd like to continue using in the 21-22 school year.
Sure. So our school district has about 2,000 students. We have four buildings, a K-2, a 3-5, a 6-8, and a 9-12. And we're a small suburban school district. I might even venture to say a large rural as opposed to a small suburban. But in terms of looking ahead to next year, I have instituted, since I've been here, a curriculum instruction and assessment review cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And so every year, two curricular departments are kind of up for review. And well, we're reviewing one, another one might be in the throes of implementation, another mm-hmm. one might be in the throes of, you know, piloting something new. So this year was kind of a pause year. Mm-hmm. We were supposed to be implementing our new science curriculum this year and getting ready to review math. So I'm looking forward next year to implementing science and starting to pilot for math. But I think one of the things that we're really working on as a district is, how do we know what our students know?
Mm-hmm.
And that whole assessment piece of things. I don't know why, but there's this mindset, and it's probably because we teach like we were taught so often.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When we were taught as students, we took the test, but never saw any of the behind the scenes work, any mm-hmm. that our teachers were doing based on those results.
Yeah.
And so we come to our profession not always prepared to do something with the results that we get from testing our kids.
Mm-hmm.
And test is literally a four-letter word, but sometimes figuratively a four-letter yeah. word, yeah. as is the word data.
Yeah.
And so, how do we, because we need to know where our students are based on this past year with the pandemic and the spring shutdown prior mm-hmm. to that. So trying to get a sense of how do we know what our kids know and how can we respond to that appropriately.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And in New York, are they going to do any type of state assessment this spring?
We just got the notice that, this federal government said we have to. New York mm-hmm. put in for the waiver. So there, it looks like it's going to be decoupled from teacher accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So like maybe they might be using it just for a baseline of mm-hmm. what impact did the pandemic have on student outcomes. But my feeling is that the standards are the destination that we're all trying to get our students to,
mm-hmm.
like trip from New York to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And so if the trip from New York to Los Angeles, we didn't get to Los Angeles last year because like the car broke mm-hmm. down.
Yeah.
So if we never made it there last year and we had to start this journey, not just, not in New York, but like now in London. So now we have yeah. to go from London to Los Angeles, yeah. but we have a flat tire as we're doing it.
Yeah.
You know, we're never going to make it. But they're not changing. They haven't changed the destination. And mm-hmm. this is the thing that really I feel very torn about, because if they're not going to change the standards, then they have to change, they have to communicate where the by they, I mean the state education departments, mm-hmm. have to communicate where the priority is, because there are teachers already have a hard enough time getting their kids to the destination in the best year. Mm-hmm. And the past years haven't been the best.
Yeah. That's right, because you know, they work on revising standards. For example, in Colorado, we had some available to start out 21 with that they've been working on, you know, since 17, and they were ready last year before the pandemic hit. But you know, and that standards rewrites and revamps are, you know, a multi-year process. So it's like,
yes,
if a state had just finished revising that, like, are they going to go back and look at that, or they're going to wait till 2025? And like you're saying, that's true. Like, what are expectations for third grade math, for seventh grade science, those type of things? And for states that are taking the assessment, I assume that they're going to be using an assessment that was written that was supposed to be used a year ago.
That's right.
So, I mean, because it's all ready to go, right? And that's easier for the testing companies to just use, have the kids learn that material. I mean, and that's what's, I mean, in a way, I think it's good to have a test just to show, hello, you know, there's a lot of gaps. There's this and that that needs to be done. But also, you know, I know there's a lot of people that want to opt out as school-wide, district-wide, and or parents for the students. Because, you know, they don't see the point in everything that's happened.
Right? Yes. And the reality is that, you know, it is certainly much harder to change the standards than mm-hmm. it is to push off assessment.
Yeah.
And so, but since the assessments are required for federal funding for the states, like, I understand how that mechanism works, mm-hmm. but are there ways to then re-examine those assessments to make them more aligned to what the expectations are mm-hmm. Of what is really happening in schools, and or to lower the level of high stakes or accountability that's connected mm-hmm. with them? Because I can't argue that the standards are a good destination. Mm-hmm. My challenge is, we know that our ability to get to that destination has been compromised. And so I don't think teachers should, or students should be faulted mm-hmm. or like, you don't graduate because you didn't learn everything that you were supposed to learn in the normal year, even though we know that this isn't the normal year. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's heartbreaking, especially to, and I'm going to go to educator hell for saying this, but especially too, since so much of what we expect students to know when they graduate are things that are above and beyond what they might actually need to know in order to be productive citizens in our society. That's, I know that's really controversial. Mm-hmm. But I have a degree in English, like a bachelor's in English, mm-hmm. and I don't read Shakespeare for fun. But we require kids to, most schools in high school, you read Shakespeare and you have to do well with that, you know, in order to pass some course or whatever. And all of that ends up leading to graduation. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you the last time that I did some type of, you know, proof or something like that for mathematics, or did some equation for physics. I took all these courses. We all took all these mm-hmm. courses in order to get out. But then you become really specialized.
Yeah.
I believe in a liberal arts education that you shouldn't have to pick and choose at like 15 years old what it is you want to do for the rest of your life. So we should mm-hmm. prepare kids for anything. So it's this really hard tension that I have about preventing kids from graduating, mm-hmm. Especially in times like this, when so much is outside of people's control.
Yeah, and it's true. Like you're thinking of a lot of parents who've been helping their kids with math, for example, middle school and high school math, right? And if it had been 25, 30 years since you took that math. I mean, when have you used it unless your field is in math or you're a math teacher? Those type of examples, like you had with Shakespeare, right? I mean, if you're teaching English and you're teaching the curriculum, yeah, you revisit those books every day, but having the degree and having read the literature, you know, those are not necessarily things that you recycle in daily life. So.
Right. I can tell you sine, cosine, and tangent, you know, have to do with calculus, but I couldn't, at this point in my life, I can't tell you anything more than that.
Let's transition into just kind of what educators are thinking about as we come upon summer. And we know that there are some educators who are looking into different roles, perhaps using that leadership degree, if they have some type of a educational leadership degree, or branching out into consulting. And I wanted to talk a little bit about your PhD, your leadership prep in particular, because when you started your PhD program, your thoughts for your dissertation were that, you know, why should somebody have to take this prep program to become a principal? You know, pay the money to get a degree, but then during your research, that changed. So tell me about that.
So yeah, I was a teacher when I started working on my administrative preparation work. And because in New York State, like most states, you can't be a teacher and just get promoted to administration. You have to get some type of certification or go back to school. And it felt a lot like a hoop that I had to jump through, like a money-making scheme for the state or the schools, like the higher ed. And so my research for my dissertation was the impact of leadership preparation on leadership practice. And I am actually happy to say that my thinking about preparation really changed through the research, because I discovered that rather than being a hoop that you have to jump through, leadership preparation is really a springboard into the profession. The truth is that being a teacher requires a different skill set than being an administrator. It's critical that administrators understand teaching and teachers, for sure. I don't think anybody from any profession would make a great school administrator. Just like my field is education, I don't know that I'd make a great hospital administrator. It takes real training to understand things like how to work with adults, because when you transition from being a classroom teacher, at least P12, to being an administrator, you're now going from working with kids to working with adults. And I don't know how many adults I've encountered over the years who have said, I don't like being the center of attention or being in front of my peers. In the meantime, though, they're very comfortable being in front of children in a classroom and being the center of attention there. It's understanding. There's a term used when teaching children, it's called pedagogy. We're familiar with the term, but the term for working with or teaching adults is called andragogy. And so the needs of adults are different than the needs of kids. And the mechanisms, the behind the scenes interactions that occur with administrators are certainly different than as teachers. So anyway, long story short, my dissertation helped me understand that the training to be an administrator is really important. But those people who are thinking about, you know, their next step and what they might be interested in doing, I think, you know, I certainly think that going into administration is a great step, but I also, you know, a huge advocate for teacher leadership. And the thing is, I started my career in administration relatively young, and my experiences of teacher leadership because I was a newer teacher, I didn't have a lot of opportunities to be a teacher leader. And had I seen that as an avenue to go down, I don't know what I would have done. I was nervous as a teacher about doing the same thing for 30 years, mm-hmm. that my job, I would be doing the same thing at day one that my next door neighbor teacher who is retiring that year would be doing. Mm-hmm. And what I understand now is that this craft of teaching evolves over time. Mm-hmm. And though, you know, the pendulum swings, you know, might be whole language one decade and phonics the next type mm-hmm. of thing. That pendulum can swing, but over time, we all should hope that we get better with the craft that we do through our experiences and interactions with others.
Yeah, and I like how you point out the teacher leadership piece, and I recently wrote a blog post that will be published in the next month for Teach Better Team about supporting your teachers in leadership positions, right? And an example is just, you know, that department chair, the grade level team lead, or even just somebody who's leading a committee. I was in several attendance committees before I became an administrator. And, you know, even as a teacher, I would call the parents, right? I was one of those people who would just go over the attendance, you know, who'd shown up for the past 2 weeks, who'd been absent, those type of things. And just make sure that, you know, the families were aware of any attendance issues. But like you're saying, these, you know, crafts, a lot of people, they'll stay in the classroom, right? They'll stay for 30 years. The craft does evolve over time. You can't have taught for 30 years without learning some new methods. And I know some of those veteran teachers were thrown into something new last year.
Sure.
Maybe against their will, right? Because they kind of always been comfortable in, you know, their own little spot in the classroom. But, you know, whether or not people decide to leave the classroom and branch out into something, or, you know, explore just more leadership opportunities, I think, you know, there are several ways to do that. You know, they can speak at professional development events in their school or district. You know, they can lead book studies, those types of things.
Yes. And I want to just say two things related to this. The first is, I hope nobody hears in what I said any diminishment of what newer teachers bring to the table. Mm-hmm. Like, I love the energy and enthusiasm and new ideas that new people bring to the table. So you don't have to be doing the work for 10, 20, 30 years to be able to contribute in a leadership capacity. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is, you know, administration and even teacher leadership are not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. Mm-hmm. And so there are other ideas to explore. Like, I love what you said about book studies. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, can't help but say things like starting a podcast mm-hmm. or a blog mm-hmm. or, you know, other low spotlight. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds like, oh my gosh, a blog or a podcast, like that's major spotlight stuff, but you don't actually see a lot of people when you're doing that. So, you know, doing it and then sharing it might be easier for some people.
Mm-hmm. And that's also okay for those introverts if they're doing something that's maybe not directly tied to their school or district, right? But is available for the masses, you know, and they could share with some of their colleagues. But yeah, that's also a way to develop that leadership capacity. So I wanted to wrap things up and ask you, out of everything we talked about today, what's one thing in particular you'd like listeners to remember?
I'd love for them to remember that engagement is more than just compliance. You and I talked a little bit about that, especially with the behavioral piece of things. And, you know, the book Engagement is Not a Unicorn, It's a Narwhal. It's that title is really about the idea that engagement doesn't have to be this mythical idea of, it's so hard to get kids engaged. That, you know, we think of it like the kids standing up at the end of a lesson applauding. Like if that's mm-hmm. where your bar is for what engagement is supposed to be, you're going to feel like a failure every time. But neither is engagement the bar so low that it's just kids doing what they're told to do, because that's mm-hmm. just compliance. There is this space that is what I call the narwhal, right? Where narwhals are a real animal, not unicorns aren't real, but mm-hmm. everybody knows about it. Narwhals mm-hmm. are a real animal. It's a whale with a horn that's like a unicorn, and they're swimming around in our oceans right now as we speak. Many people don't know about them, and if they do, they don't realize that they're real, and even mm-hmm. if they do, they don't necessarily know their name. Engagement, real engagement, is like that too. Real engagement is not kids applauding for the teacher, but kids feeling good about the work that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And when we set our target on that, not only will we feel more satisfied in the work that we're doing, but the kids will too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's great to end with, because you want those kids to have something to take away from the lesson, right? To report to their parents at home, to, you know, really remember at the end of the school year or the next school year, something that they did that they really got a lot out of. So where can people find you online and connect with you?
So I hope that all listeners go to my website, which is lionsletters.com. So that's lionsletters.com, lionsletters.com. And then you can find me on Twitter at lionsletters as well, and LinkedIn, Heather Lyon with a Y. And you can buy my book on Amazon or barnesandnoble.com.
Sounds great. Well, thanks so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast today, and have a great rest of your day.
Thanks for having me.